actually it's just that absolute belief in what we are doing in terms of the product that we've got, where we can go with this. You know, we've put a lot of our own money into it, 4 years of our own time, and we absolutely believe we'll get there. And it's that resilience that all founders need to have.
Raj Thiruchelvaraja, the CEO and founder of Hytro, a wearable tech company leveraging blood flow restriction technology that's currently being used by Premiership football clubs as well as NFL and NBA teams in the US. Any advice for those who may be similarly thinking that they want to ditch the day job?
It's a tough one, that one. In some ways, it's not.
First question, that moment that you questioned the career path that you were on, which many of us have done or will do, and decided that becoming an entrepreneur was what you wanted to do. Take me back there. Was it based on wanting to ultimately be in control of your own destiny?
I think it's probably a few different things. And actually, just a quick digress is that nowadays what you find is people starting out wanting to be entrepreneurs.
Yes.
And so it's a real switch of like, when back in the day when I was in my 20s at university, that wasn't really a thing. It was, okay, you're going to go and join a big four accountancy firm, you're going to go and join an investment bank, join a consultancy firm. And that switch, which is really interesting. For me personally, I was at a consultancy firm, and I remember I just finished a project, and that project we had absolutely destroyed ourselves with working on that. The end of that project, I think there was a few of us, we'd worked 36 hours out leaving the office, there, you know, no sleep. It was horrendous. And then a few weeks after that, it was kind of end of year reviews. You know, we got good ratings and a little bonus, and it was like, not really sure what I'm doing this for. And I could see the trajectory to make it to a partner at the firm. And I was thinking, I'm not really enjoying the work. I don't really want that. What's the purpose? Why am I here doing it? So that got me really kind of questioning things and thinking about, okay, where do I want to go? What am I interested in? I've always been interested in sport, health and fitness. But at that point, I think you mentioned in the intro, I took a sabbatical because I think I'm not quite clear what I want to do. So I said, I just want some time out. I want a break. I want to sleep for a start. I took, I think it was 3 months out, went to Africa for a bit, came back, and then took another 4 months out, went to South America, traveled around. I think experiences, seeing the world again, I've always done this during my life. That really helps with perspective, clarity of what you want to do. Got back. And I think for me, thinking about having control, running my own business has been something that I've thought about for a number of years. And it was a case of, okay, so now I'm ready. Now I've got experience, I've got skills, I can do it, I feel comfortable running that business. The learning curve would undoubtedly be immense, and it has been, and it still will be, and it always will be. But I felt ready to do it, and that's kind of when I made the leap.
Have you heard of the rocking chair test?
No, I haven't, no.
Okay, so interviewed a very cool guy, actually. I helped him at Virgin Startup when I was working for Richard Branson's not-for-profit. So Jamal Easel is his name, and he was working in the city, you know, earning pretty good money, decided to go traveling, was kind of, you know, questioning what he was doing. And it's like a great clip for the episode when he said, I was sat on a bus, you know, 12-hour journey or whatever, going across Vietnam, and this guy next to me, this American guy, just said, are you happy with your life? Are you happy with what do you do? And he told him, and he's like, you know, you happy doing that? And Jamal said, I sat bolt upright for literally this 12-hour journey, just questioning everything that I've done. Like, what will I leave behind? What will I be known for? Yeah. You know, all the kind of like legacy stuff. And it was, you know, the rocking chair test being that, you know, if you're sat in your rocking chair at the end of your life and you look back, would you be happy with signing off and going, okay, thanks world, this has been one hell of a ride, I'm out of here. And he was like, and I wasn't, you know. And he goes, I literally changed everything when I got back and started this business called Change Please, which is retraining homeless people as baristas, giving them a living wage, giving them a roof above their heads, giving them counselling, all those kinds of things. And through Virgin Startup, you know, I introduced him. The Virgin companies don't speak to each other a lot of the time, so I introduced him to Virgin Atlantic. Virgin Atlantic now serves coffee on the plane. Virgin Trains serves coffee on the trains. Went out to Necker for a mentoring session with Richard. Okay. So it's like a great story.
Okay.
But the rocking chair test, and I think it's something that we could all probably do at some point in our lives when we're having those kind of sabbatical moments.
It's definitely that point where you're thinking about it and you go, and particularly for me, it's like, if not now, when? when, right? So it's like, you've got to make that jump at some point. Mm. And you're right. You don't want to be too late. You're sitting there rocking your show thinking, oh, I should have done all these things, right?
Yeah.
So absolutely, yeah.
If you're enjoying this podcast, can I ask you to do one thing for me? That is to hit the subscribe button. On average, we have just 10% of people who listen to this podcast actually subscribe to it. If you subscribe to it, not only will you be the first person to be notified as soon as any brand new content goes live, it also means that we can go out and get even better guests for the show for you to enjoy. So just take 15 seconds of your time just to hit that subscribe button and I'll be eternally grateful. Thank you very much. You said previously that you're taking like a typical career path for someone with an Asian background. Yeah. What was the reaction from family and friends?
That's a good question. You've been doing your research as well for that. Wow.
A little bit.
So very typically for Asian families, and particularly over here, it's get your education, go to university, go, you know, join a bank, you know, stay or become a doctor or a lawyer or whatever, and do that for the rest of your life. I think, again, the world is changing. And I think we're seeing that more in the Asian community as well here. So, for example, I did a podcast last year for the British Asian Entrepreneurs Network, the Bay HQ. Mm. And they're doing a phenomenal job of bringing the British entrepreneurs, Asian entrepreneurs together, because there is there's a huge community now of Asian entrepreneurs, and it's really booming. Mm. And there's a real support within that network as well. I think family and friends are actually incredibly supportive. It's actually surprisingly so.
Right.
I've got quite a lot of my family who are out in the States and in Canada, and they're seeing what we're doing and they go, this is cool, this is great, and really well done. And it's somewhat surprising because it's not the classical model. Mm. But I think there's now, I guess because I'm a lot older and I'm not really taking a risk of my career, there's just support, which is great. Different for me to maybe a 21-year-old do it. I'm doing it, and let's say it all doesn't work, I've got a career to get back onto if I want to.
Yeah.
Or I've learned so much in this journey that I can take it and do something else, which would probably be another startup, right? So
interesting. And you mentioned, it might have been in that interview actually, questioning about whether it was power or money.
Mm.
Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. I think understanding the motivation for doing it is really important. I've actually debated this a lot in my head in terms of the reasons why being an entrepreneur and having a startup is really important to me. I'm still not 100% clear on it. I think there's a number of different factors. There's an element of wanting to prove something to myself, for sure.
Yeah,
I think it's, can I do this? I've always believed I can, but until you do it, you don't know.
Yeah.
So definitely in that. There's an element of being in control of it. So I think particularly now, I'd probably struggle to be in a startup where I wasn't in charge.
Mm.
I think I'm very different to a lot of founders as well. So a lot, I'm quite introverted. It's interesting. Like if you see my social setting, you probably think, oh, he's quite sociable, but I actually like being on my own quite a lot. I'm not a massive people person. And that's very different, I think, to a lot of people. I view the world very differently to a lot of people. A lot of people I hear who say, oh, I'm a real people person, when I meet them, they just love talking about themselves. All right, that's not being a people. I think we're coming to different things here.
Yeah, yeah.
I've always listened more than I have spoken. I've just changed that a little bit to be on things like this, which is a bit difficult.
Two ears, one mouth.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Exactly. So yeah, we'll see. Really
interesting. Okay. I'm just reading a book by someone I'm interviewing. Stas from SES, who Des Wenz is also the co-founder of Through Dark, like the high performance clothing brand as well. And it's interesting seeing, listening to what he's taken from, you know, that very disciplined life, and he was a sniper, so very solitary life, to then, you know, treating their startup, you know, with those kind of same self-disciplines when it comes to the systems and the processes that need to be in place, and the quality, like the attention to detail.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in exploring how we can improve performance and indeed accelerate our recovery. Mm. So you co-founded Hytro, which is based on blood flow restriction training, something that I've known has been around for a little while.
Yeah.
But previously, I mean, I might be wrong, but the preserve of elite athletes and medical practitioners. So you and your co-founders come up with wearable tech that makes it scalable. And initially your idea, I believe, was to make it available to all of us, gym users, weekend warriors, etc. Mm. Can you explain, first of all, for those listening, how BFR works and how it works in relation to Hytro?
Yeah, so the idea really came from my co-founder, Dr. Warren Bradley. So Warren has a a PhD in human physiology, and he spent a decade working in pro sports. And you're right, so BFR has been classically used in pro sports for rehabilitation, also with kind of medical practitioners as well. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is that it is a phenomenal tool to regenerate muscle tissue, particularly at low loads. So the classic use for rehabilitation is post-surgery, use BFR, because you can lift low loads and get the same impact as high loads, but you're not putting the body under so much stress. So we were talking about your knee issue at the moment, it'd be perfect for that.
Right, interesting.
What Warren saw was he went through around the clubs, obviously, in his career, and he's worked at England Rugby, Munster Rugby, Premier League football clubs, Championship football clubs. Right. And he's seen BFR being used in all these environments for rehabilitation. And Warren, being kind of a scientist, thought, okay, they're seeing phenomenal results, players getting back to play quicker than you'd expect, and he wanted to know more. So he did a deep dive into the science. Now, when you compare the science of BFR against things you probably use, like massage guns, compression gear, ice baths, there's far more research in BFR than there is in anything else. Mm. But then if you ask the man on the street, okay, have you heard of blood flow restriction on BFR? They're like, what are you talking about? It sounds a bit scary, right?
Whereas ice baths, everybody's heard of them now. Wim Hof doing the TV program about it.
So. Yeah, and I was telling you earlier that we've done a study that shows... we'll have to be careful about when we talk about this, but it shows at the moment that BFR plus ice bath really is a really powerful tool. Mm. And so Warren saw this in the clubs, and then he wanted to know why it wasn't being scaled. Why doesn't everybody know about it? Why aren't you using it for the other ways you can use BFR, which is accelerating recovery, hypertrophy, muscle size and strength, increasing endurance? You can use it for so many different things. And the reason was very simply the tools in place weren't scalable. So they were expensive, like £2,000 to £10,000. That we needed practitioner supervision, one-on-one. Mm. You just couldn't scale that kind of tool. Just really impractical. It was really impractical. Have you ever seen one as well? You've got wires, boxes. It's just you can't do that. Mm. So the solution was to integrate it into wearables. Therefore, it makes it really easy to deploy. It also makes it safe for two aspects, which is positioning of the strap. It needs to be the uppermost part of the arm or leg for safety reasons. And then also you have to make sure it doesn't occlude the arterial vein, which is really important. So we did that. So it took a lot of kind of R&D to get to that. And now we have the first scalable BFR product. So really what we're doing is unleashing the power of BFR in the first product that enabled it to do that.
Interesting. Okay, that's really interesting. And what was that initial vision when you met your co-founders, when you started having those... Mm. conversations, because I'm assuming things moved along and we'll come to like the pivot later on. But
So I think at the beginning we probably weren't as clear as we should be. I think one of the things that I've learned, as well as the CEO of the company, is focus is really important, and actually saying no to some of the opportunities. One of the beauties, but also the curse of Hytro, is that it's almost applicable to every single person in a different way.
Right.
And so there's, at the beginning, there's almost a sense of being greedy, like, oh, we want, you know, the old lady who wants to use it for sarcopenia, you know, staving off muscle loss. Yeah. But we want it, the young guy who's just had, who wants to put on muscle size and strength. We want the female athlete who's got an ACL injury. We want it all. And actually, you can't do that as a business. And it was at the beginning very much thinking was alongside of like the gym consumer. It was at the beginning of the company.
Yeah.
What we quickly realized is actually the greatest place to authenticate the product, and actually our route as a company through Warren and his background, was with pro sports. They already understood the product because they used it, but now we can say you can use it for all these other ways. Mm. We had a natural community in there, and we can talk about that later as well, because that's actually really powerful for us as a company.
Yeah.
And that for us, as Hytrend, it has done for the last 2 years in particular, the awareness, the credibility, the authentication, the performance stories we get are incredible. Mm. And that's just transformed the business. So really focusing on the pro sports and saying, actually, don't worry about a D2C consumer at the moment. Don't do the medical stuff just yet. Okay. Do that. And then that's really blown us up as a company.
Yeah, and I see, again, I'm sure it's probably changing by the week, but you've got something like 60 plus sports
it's
teams.
80 now.
80. There you go. See, 80, time I researched 80. It a couple of weeks ago.
Well, that was last week, yeah. So, yeah, it is going through the roof at the moment, yeah.
And which sports predominantly? See a lot of football teams there, rugby teams, a cricket team.
So, well, we started domestically, so rugby, cricket, football, and then it's gone wider. So Formula One was an interesting one, so we worked with Alpine as well, so Alpine Academy and the Formula One team. Now we're expanding to the US. So we had our first NFL team. We've got our first Washington Commanders.
Dude, Raiders fan.
First NBA team, Utah Jazz. First NHL team, Philly Flyers. A couple of MLS teams, Nashville, Philadelphia Union. And there's more. I'm just heading out there this afternoon to the States with Warren to speak to more NBA teams, to see some of the kind of colleges out there. So it's moving really fast right now. We can operate in many different sports. Got a lot of golf interest at the moment as well, which is interesting to see how we can help with that.
Yeah.
But again, we just have to be a bit careful that we don't try to be all things to all people, even though we can be. We've got to just sequence it appropriately.
So when it comes to the vision that you have now, you're uber focused on the professional sports teams, and you started out with particular sports, which obviously have the most number of teams within that, and then with the States is kind of an obvious one as well, with how big NFL, NBA, MLB.
And the college market as well.
I'm a huge American football fan, have been for decades. I used to fly out and watch the Raiders play when they're in Oakland, and San Francisco 49ers as well. So I know that the college teams, you know, 100,000 people in the stadiums, billion-dollar businesses, and run far more professionally, probably, you know, with the volume then, and the size of the sports teams, of course, instead of you needing like a squad of, I don't know, 20 to 30 for football, you're talking, you know, 50 plus for American football, for example. So your market's going to be that much bigger.
Yeah, it's the natural progression for the business. It makes perfect sense from a scale perspective. You're right. It's also what we're finding is the sales cycles are quicker.
Right.
So it's like the budgetary requirements aren't so tight. The opportunity for the numbers of teams out there are huge.
Yeah.
It just makes sense for us. We're not abandoning the UK market. We're trying to consolidate it next year in particular. There's much more for us to do here. But to grow and grow fast, which is the idea for Hytro, we need to be over in the States. And so that's why we're making the push at the moment. We've got a lot of conferences lined up next year. We're hiring for the US market as well to get kind of more business development managers over there as well.
Interesting.
And so that's the push for the business, alongside the medical aspect as well.
I was going to say, and you know, the thought in my head was then, just because I'm reading that book, is like, do you then speak to like the military, for example? Mm. And the numbers would just be crazy.
Yeah, so there's so many use cases for the military. If you think about kind of what Hytra can do, like if you're out in the middle of nowhere, I mean, you can have a good workout, you can look after yourself, you can also help yourself recover, you know,
absolutely,
in between it. So there's so many different use cases. The difficulty with the military is the bureaucracy. And
I was going to say layers of rent. I even tried to get a podcast done with the Navy, and it, you know, 12-month conversation that then goes, actually, we'll kick it down the road to the next budget. Then it gets kicked down the road to the next budget, and you're just like,
That's exactly that. So we're speaking to a lot of people who have connections, who are trying to work with the military, and it's like, absolutely, let's have those conversations, but know when you're going to get into the military is actually really difficult to know. And then there's sometimes a tendering process as well. And it's absolutely, we're keen to do it. We can help them. We've got a product that will solve a lot of their problems, but actually we need to get in front of the right people. And that's a bit of a challenge at the moment. So I can, from a business point of view, I have more clarity on pro sports. I have more clarity on the medical, more clarity on what we're going to do with the consumers. The military is a bit of an unknown. So, but a huge opportunity at the same time.
Indeed. Okay. And when it comes to, so it sounds like you're uber focused with that. Do you already set out, this is who we're then going to focus on? Is this stage two? This is stage three? Is that something you can talk about?
Yeah. We kind of think about that all the time, that strategically we have to think, because again, the challenge for Hytro is the sequencing. It's not the scalability. We're fundraising at the moment, and we've spoken to many VCs, and VCs obviously check about scalability, and that's not an issue for Hytro. The issue is the sequencing of the market, so you don't fall over trying to achieve something, because you can try and take too much of the small team that we have at the moment, and actually we're not going to do anything well.
No.
And I've been guilty of that in the past, and as we started the business, trying to do all things. So absolutely, at the moment, UK pro sports, US pro sports and college market, we're doing some kind of initial work in the D2C in the US and initial work in the medical market over here. And that's it for the time being. And that will see us through 2024. And then from then, it starts to expand in the different areas.
Okay. Question that pops into my head is, who are you competing against then?
So obviously there are other BFR devices, but they have, I mean, there's some very, very good devices out there, but they still have the problems that we solve for. Scalability, the usability, the ease. It's very difficult with other BFR devices to put them on squads of 30 people or to give them to people to use unsupervised. We have publications that show Hytro is safe to be used unsupervised. No other BFR device has that. But now we're being bucketed actually more with recovery devices as well. So you kind of got the kind of the leg compression units that come out that people, you know, probably shouldn't name separate products, but that are widely used. But then again, we're so much more usable. So we have at the moment an analog product. There's no complexity with digital aspects. We might look at that down the line, but one of the things we love about our product is the beautiful simplicity of it. So it's, and that's what coaches love as well. So you give it to a player, you can use it, you know, they don't have to think about it too much. You know it's going to impact them. And so stacked against other recovery products, we're again scientifically proven to have a probably bigger effect. Not probably a bigger effect. Warren would hate me for it, probably. A bigger effect. And actually it's easier to use. So therefore, and actually we're cheaper than motor recovery products as well. So therefore we're in a really good place in that point.
Interesting. What action did you take initially then with regards to getting the product to market? Because to start with, you had a different product was the plan,
Yeah, I think quite right in the beginning, I said, so we weren't really clear on where we were going, and that's probably my fault. I think a lot of it happened slightly naturally, slightly organically. And it's really interesting because I've said it before that a lot of brands start going, oh, we're going to build a community, we're going to build a community. And it's like a purpose, that's kind of, it's almost like it feels a little bit disingenuous, but it lacks authenticity.
Yeah.
It's like, we're going to build this community, and I'm like, you're going to be our community,
you're going to force you to be our community.
And I've never liked that. People often get that out of the Gymshark stuff that happened, and that was really authentic, and they built it, and they did a great job with it, and I don't think they were even meant to do it, and that's happened to us. So our community is in the starting point is pro sport practitioners and coaches like Warren. And it happened because we gave them the product. They liked it. They used it with their athletes. They saw results. And then they said two things to us often, which is, why didn't I think of this? Because it's so simple actually in many ways. And then can we get involved in some way, like invest or, you know, be associated with a company? And more often than not, we said investing is great. And actually we need some, you know, we need funds to grow. And so we have over 80 pro sport coaches now invested in Hytro.
Really?
Everyone from, you know, Max Verstappen's performance coach to Premier League coaches.
Yes.
That's our community. And you know, we have many more that are just kind of want to help and, you know, and part of that. And it opens up doors for us. It's a great advocacy. It's network. It's very difficult for other brands to replicate something like that as well, because it's just so real. It's like you use the product, you believe in it, you use it with your athletes, which means you trust us, you see the results, and you're kind of that part of the Hytro team.
And then they
now
tell their friends about are athletes with other clubs, and especially in a, you know, I think sports like football, where people move on quite regularly these days and they end up in another team, and yet they've got friends with the old team, and they're all having these conversations, be that football, rugby, cricket, whatever.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot. Actually, the turnover in sports of the staff is actually quite, in some ways, it's quite shocking, actually, how much it happens. Mm. But it does, in a way, benefit us, because staff will buy into Hytro and just take it to the next team, because they'll know the performance benefits. Yeah. We've had coaches buy Hytro for three different teams already because they've moved so much. But every time they just go, I need Hytro because I can see the competitive advantage.
That's brilliant.
So that's great. It's great for us. Yeah.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about the benefits then. Somebody, you know, listening into this, I'm amazed. And so you said, like, the different uses that you've got, because you think with most products you're looking to solve one problem, but you're actually able to use it for performance and for recovery. Hypertrophy you talked about as well.
So it's actually a little bit of a problem at the moment in some ways, because this is one of the reasons why we're not quite ready for the consumer market, because actually by the time we get to that point, it has to be crystal clear in terms of how we convey it.
Yeah.
At the moment, we're having quite scientifically in-depth conversations with sports practitioners, and that's great because then we can learn how they're using it. So we can use it for prepare a train recovery is kind of often how we talk about it. So often they'll use it, like, for example, Cameron Norrie sent me a picture yesterday morning. He was using Hytra on his balcony here in London, like preparing. It helps him kind of warm up the ligaments, get his body ready before he actually goes and trains.
Got it.
You can then use it for training as well. For often teams will use it for training in a kind of a low load day, because again, you don't put your body to much stress, but you get the same adaptations. The classic use and what we see most of Hytra is recovery. Some really great examples, for example, are like the Catalan Dragons. They use it on a bus straight after a game. So everyone puts the Hytra on. Strength and conditioning coach will blow the whistle. They'll all strap in for 5 minutes. They'll blow again. They'll strap out, and they do that three times.
Hope you got that on video.
We're trying to get that on video. We need to get some of that on video, actually. But sometimes that's difficult with some of the teams. But absolutely, we've got so many use case examples of that. Post-game for recovery is often the first thing they do. And then it's classic uses for rehabilitation. And we're actually seeing many female athletes at the moment using it for ACL rehabilitation.
I was going to say, it's like a big problem, isn't it?
Yeah.
And there's not enough research done.
No. Warren was talking to me about how a lot of the research he's ever done in kind of sporting context has always been with men. Mm. It's like there's not enough work done in the women's game. That's starting to change. We're doing research already with Bristol City Women's, Wales RFU Women's.
Oh, are you?
Yep. So we're having a look at the impact of BFR on women in particular, so we can understand that more. We're looking at how that impacts menstrual cycles as well. That's going to be a really big thing. So there's loads to do in that area. There's not enough clarity on it.
No.
So that will hopefully be something that we can help with going forward.
And tell me, when you pivoted then from that initial idea, what was it like making that decision? How early on was it? And third part to the question, was everyone in agreement?
So it became a screw it, just do it moment, really, because it was, we'd been thinking about it for a while. So it was becoming clearer and clearer that was the route we needed to go. There was definite disagreement, and we have some robust conversations in our team, and it should always be the case. We see, again, like, we see the world from our team very differently from the people that are in it, and that's useful. There was, I think by the time we made the decision, I think there was consensus, but we're not 100% there. But then ultimately it sits on my shoulders to go, this is what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is, okay, let's go full hog pro sport. Let's forget everything else. So we had to cut certain things out of the business, grow it, just do it, focus solely on the pro sports element. And then it took off from there. So it's kind of April 2022 is probably really, we doubled down on pro sports. And that was when it just blew up through 2022. And it was with hindsight, the right move. Mm-hmm. But you can only tell with that with hindsight. It's like sitting here now going, yeah, I got 80 pro teams. Yeah, I knew it was always going to happen. Didn't, but you made that, well, we made that decision and we stuck with it. And focus, it was the big thing for us, yeah.
Who was the first sports team?
I think it was Leeds Rhinos.
Was it?
Rhinos, yeah, first one. Yep.
Who would be, for you, like, top of the bucket list that you'd want to...
Well, I'm a Liverpool fan, but we've already got...
Me too, man, yes.
We've got some product with Liverpool, but not quite the whole thing embedded. So when it's embedded in Liverpool, I'll be very happy, I think, yeah.
Have you faced any resistance to adoption?
I think one of the big things is this gets quite technical for this podcast maybe, but is sort of like pressure validation. So when you have a normal BFR cuff, you can actually get to a particular pressure. Now there's a lot of research on this, which is actually you don't need it needs to be within a range, and we sit very nicely in the range.
Okay.
And we've got the studies that show that, so we've proven it in lab settings. So we had to get that publication done, and now we have it. It's a much easier conversation to say, actually, this publication shows we're in the range of pressure, which then mitigates the issue that you had. So that was probably the big thing which we had to overcome. And again, it was useful going to practitioners first, because then you get that feedback before you go anywhere else with it. So that was probably the big thing, yeah.
Okay. And what kind of results have athletes been getting using it?
So really impressive ones, thankfully. I mean, a really good story is actually kind of is Cam Norrie, actually. So Cam started, obviously, British number one tennis player. So he started using Hytro. He was introduced to it around about Wimbledon time. Mm-hmm. He started using it and he really intrinsically believed in it. He felt better for it. So he was using it for a particular issue at the time. It solved that issue. He then baked it into his preparation and his recovery, which is obviously why, you know, he was doing it at the moment when he showed me the picture. And he uses it all the time. And what happened with Cam and actually his team is that they believe in the product so much that Cam invested in Hytro, his physio invested, his other physio invested, his strength and conditioning coach invested, and one of his best mates invested.
Really?
Yeah, because it's just...
Five for the price of one.
Yeah, it's true belief in the product. Wow. And then with some of the studies we're seeing, for example, like 82% reduction in fatigue. We're seeing something like 30% reduction in joint pain. So we're seeing real metrics that we can actually start to quantify.
Yeah.
And we've got a big pipeline of research at the moment across a number of sports teams, which will hopefully show more of those kind of metrics that we can then talk about as well.
Interesting. And there was me after my, what was it, about 12K on Sunday, on Monday morning, suddenly feeling this knee pain and sat there with my Tiger Balm and my hot water bottle.
Yeah, we'll get you some shorts.
Trying to figure out what's going on here then.
Yeah, definitely get you some shorts.
Interesting. I appreciate it. So, and also, I always just think, you know, when it comes to different sports, when you've got elite athletes who give you that buy-in, who are, you know, the top 0.1% of tennis players in the world or motor racing drivers, etc., do you get that kind of buy-in with a sports team as opposed to, like, tennis is a very individual sport, and I would say F1 is the same, even though there's a couple of drivers, there's clearly massive competition in the different teams. What are your thoughts on that when it comes to teams versus, like, individual sports?
In terms of buy-in in particular. Mm. So it's interesting because with a team, well, actually with both, for us the route is always through the coach anyway. So
got
in
it.
The first instance is through coach, and we use our network for that.
Yeah.
So the coach understands how to do it. In kind of Cam's case, it was through, like, his physio. In most of the teams, it's through S&C coaches or physios, can be anything, or performance coaches. They then give it to the athletes, educate them how to use it, and we help with that. Getting player buy-in is incredibly important, though. And obviously, what we do with the Hytro product is so simple and easy to use, and you can feel it immediately. So if you compare it to, for example, like a supplement where you kind of got to hope it's working, you don't really know. If you use Hytro, you will feel it immediately. So that really helps. So players can kind of see it, use it, believe in it. Then they use it and they see the results. And often what's really important, and we found, is that you get an advocate in a club and you get someone like a senior player. So for example, like I mentioned Catalan Dragons, Sam Tompkins, Man of Steel, you know, one point say a legendary rugby league player. He was a big advocate for Hytro. It's like you got someone like Sam, then it becomes a no-brainer. And often that's quite important. And actually having individual players who advocate for the product is useful for that. So it's less resistance for a coach coming in, because ultimately coaches, we need to make coaches' lives easier. They don't want to be enforcing on a player. They actually want players coming to them going, have you heard about Hytro? Can we use some of that?
Yeah.
And that's what it's increasingly becoming as well.
Interesting. Okay. I was just, like, thoughts going through my mind then, thinking about someone like a Cam Norrie who's, like, super focused, have got to, you know, top 10 in the world, number one British male tennis player, and then you've got teams of individuals who are, like, massive difference in age range as well. I can't remember the name of the player, but former Everton player who just retired at 41, and you think you've got people coming through, like, the academy ranks who are, like, teenagers.
Yeah, yeah.
So very, very different. But if you get an advocate, like you say, Sam has been there, done it.
Yeah.
That's a great way to grow the business. So talking a little bit more, you know, action steps as well then, to get to where you are now. Next obvious market is the US for you.
Yeah.
And again, how do you make a dent? You know, whenever you read stories about anybody in any industry trying to make a dent in the US, it's just such a vast landscape over there. And I'm assuming you go through the practitioners again, try and build the coaches network.
Yeah, very, very much so. Try and do it in the most authentic way you can, or we can. So I'm flying out there this afternoon with Warren, and we've already got a number of meetings with NBA teams lined up and universities, and it's come through our network.
Right.
And we had that already. That's how we've already sold to the USA teams in the USA without really doing much. It's come through coach talking to coach, and then it's actually authentically growing the business. We then obviously need to have a visible presence over there. So we've got kind of a plan of conferences we need to be out there. We know it's very much a relationship game as well. So we need to be out there speaking to them, understanding their problems. How can we work with them? Mm. We need to have local knowledge in the team as well.
Yeah,
so
exactly. We're hiring on the ground.
So you need boots on the ground. You need people to understand the market. Yeah. So hiring is always a challenge as a startup, but that's one of the things we're doing at the moment.
Julian Hearn at Hewlett, Al Barrett at Grenade, also the same thing.
Yeah, and if you get it wrong at our stage, it can be really costly. So that's important. And then just backing it up with actually good kind of service to the team. So making sure that they're happy, they use it, they embed it.
Yeah.
So educate them and then tell the stories of how they're using it. It's very similar to kind of what we've done over here.
Yeah.
What we don't want to do is have some kind of brands do this where you kind of pay to play you don't know if they're using the product or not. That doesn't work for us. We want authentic use of the product. We want to see the results and we want to tell everyone about that. That's what we need.
Got it. And I'm sure you've thought of these things already, but do you look at going to like the MLB, or do you go to the NFL and you have those conversations with to be the authorized license
it's slightly different over there in terms of that is an option. I think it's interesting how it's happened so far that we've kind of sold to individual teams in those leagues. I think we'd like to have those conversations, but I think there's a point we need to get slightly bigger to get the retention a little bit. It's interesting that we've had some of that attention from MLS, actually. So it's getting there. I think next year, hopefully, we can have some of those conversations. There's definitely a potential route to do a centralized deal in the US market that isn't kind of applicable over here. Mm. So you're absolutely on the money on that. But it's difficult to plan for those kind of things. You don't know what the possibility is just yet. So work the strategy so you're trying for that, but actually if it doesn't work you've got other routes as well.
And who would you want to get on board in the US? Who would be like the top of your wish list?
I guess
if you're allowed such a thing.
I guess top of the wish list would be somebody who is known for their kind of dedication to recovery in particular, for their sport, who would be a great advocate for, known for using BFR. So someone like LeBron James would be a fantastic person to get on board, I guess. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I read that you've said you'll never be ready to be a founder in a previous article. How have you coped with the unique challenges, which I can swear to myself, of founding, starting, and now, scaling a business?
Yeah, it's... I think the difficulty with being a founder is you're always doing something that's unknown. Mm. You're always living in the chaos, right? And it's you're always looking for that clarity all the time. But then there's always something else. It's a really unique and difficult to explain position in many ways, particularly being the CEO and the founder of a company. The learning curve, I said, is absolutely immense, and you've got to ride that. But for me, I'm not interested in what you think, but for me, the central job that I have is today I have a problem, tomorrow that I've never seen before, I don't know what to do, and tomorrow I've got to find a solution.
Yeah.
It's not me sitting there going, okay, I'll work this one out myself. That's not how it works. I have to use my resources around me, the team, anything else external, to find a way forward. And it's always, I often come across people going, oh, I don't know how to do that. Well, in a founding life, you don't know how to do a lot of things, but you've got to find that answer.
Absolutely.
And that's the key to it. You've got to be able to find an answer when you have no idea at the start what to do.
Mm. Go on. Yeah, no, I was going to say, because I had some of those conversations and it's like, this is the problem. And I'm like, I don't want the problem. Mm. I want the possible solutions. Yeah. I'm not expecting you to give me, the silver bullet for the solution. But what I expect you to bring me is a number of options at how we can actually solve this potentially.
Yeah.
And then it's like you say, trying to focus in on it. It's trying to make a decision, because any decision is better than no decision. Yeah. And I always remember Al Barrett saying, I'm chief firefighter. That is what I do on a daily basis. I literally put out fires,
Okay, yeah.
But as you said, it's being able to leverage your team to do that, because otherwise you know, and I've found myself again this year in that position again. You find yourself in the weeds, in the minutiae of it, and you can't be in there for very long.
Yeah.
You know, you need that time, I think, to zoom out and see the full picture.
Well, that's the difficulty, isn't it? When you've got to do all the work, and particularly at our stage, when we're quite a small company at the moment, you've got to do the work, and then you've got to take the time to step back and actually see what's going on. And that balance is really hard to find. Like, the thinking time is actually what takes the business forward.
Yeah.
Whereas the doing time is just gets you through the day to day, and you've got to do both. And then you've got to fundraise as well, and you've got to juggle so many different things.
Yeah.
There's a lot to be said for having founders with generalist skill sets as well. I think I'm a jack of all trades, a master of nothing. You know, and actually that works out well for startup life.
Yeah.
And I think the other kind of key aspect is you just got to keep going. Often, like, there's, I think the most rational thing to do for most founders at any one point would be to give up, because it can be unbelievably hard, and sometimes you can't see the end route, but you've got to almost believe you're going to get there.
Yeah.
And we've been on this journey now for 4 years, and there's been definite points where most people would have gone, why are you still doing this? Like, you know, you're not getting anywhere, it's not good, what's happening? And actually it's just that absolute belief in what we are doing in terms of the product that we've got, where we can go with this. You know, we've put a lot of our own money into it, a lot of 4 years of our own time. We absolutely believe we'll get there. And it's that resilience that all founders need to have.
Yeah. And you clearly believe you're going to get there. Where is there now?
So
tell me.
That's an interesting question, because you'll never get there. That's the thing. That's the founder's mentality as well, isn't it?
Where,
you always think, oh, when I get there, when we get there, and it'll always be more, it'll always be bigger. My wife says that to me as well. It's like, you never, like, you're never happy about this thing. You always think about the next thing.
Yeah.
But I was talking to other founders about this the other day, and it's like, I think that's a required mindset in some ways, but you've got to enjoy the moment and enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
I do personally struggle with that, because I'm always thinking about the next thing. It's like, you know, obviously, like, people like Cam Norrie, Sam Warburton coming aboard, so saying to our first US teams, great, oh, we should go celebrate. Yeah. I'm just thinking about what's next.
Yeah.
Okay, how do we capitalize on this? What's the next thing we need to do strategically?
Mm.
So I think there never will be a there. I know you never arrive at it. You just keep going on that journey.
And it is, isn't it? It's a cliche, but it's the journey. It's not the destination. And so, I mean, that's the beauty of having had a podcast for nearly 7 years and hearing so many people kind of reiterate that. But it does surprise me. Like, I use an example of like chatting to Rowena Bird, one of the founders of Lush, and then this was just before lockdown, I think, when we did like my annual event, 2019, I guess it was. And them having come to 25 years, it was officially a $1 billion business. And I was like, what did you do? Nothing. Honey, what do you mean you didn't do anything? She was like, we should really celebrate it, shouldn't we? And I was like, yeah, you should. What do you mean you didn't do anything? You know, and that always surprises me. But, but Rowena must be, you know, mid-60s and the other founders are, you know, late 60s, early 70s even, and you just think, age is irrelevant, isn't it? You're already thinking of, you know, what is the next thing? What are we going to do next?
I remember reading Shoe Dog, which is
it's one of my favourite books.
Brilliant, for Phil Knight, who founded Nike. And one of the takeaways for me at the end of that book, it felt really sad in terms of the journey was over for him. And it was almost like he loved the journey, didn't actually like the end of it in many ways. And I don't think I'll forget that bit. And there's actually, that could be very true. You always think you're going to get there. And I think the founder mentality has always got to be more. And it's actually, maybe you don't want to arrive at that destination.
Yeah.
So we keep going.
It's interesting. I interviewed the current CEO of Fender Guitars, but he was chief marketing officer at Nike.
Right.
And I said to him, I love that book. Amazing. How true is the book? Yeah. And he went, 100% true. And I went, fantastic. I said, what about the movie that's just come out? Because I saw it like 3 days ago. Yeah. And he went, no, not true.
I've
and I went, no, really?
I've heard that one as well.
And he was there like when they, you know, signed those first shoe deals with, like, you know, Michael Jordan and brought out the signature line, which, you know, transformed, the whole playing field when it comes to sports, really. But no, it is interesting. you know, and chatting to different founders, different CEOs and MDs, etc., about, you know, the challenges they face and, you know, whether you celebrate those those wins along the way. But even this year, and we're 4 years as a podcast agency this year as well, and even this year our questions, you know, throwing it all in again, you need, you just get a couple of setbacks, don't you?
Yeah,
you know,
okay. But
you know, from the high of literally having like our best month ever, best quarter ever, best year ever, to then hitting a setback, and then just going, you know, then you get another one, and then you just question the whole thing.
But how serious was that question for you? Or was it actually just it was a fleeting moment, or what was it?
I probably look, yeah. You kind of look back, well, the 365 days in a year, how many days did I actually question that? And it's a couple, you know, which is just a bump in the road, isn't it?
But you'd be probably insane if you didn't question it occasionally, right? So you have to.
True.
That's the logical and rational thing to do. But then most founders aren't logical and rational, right? Because you wouldn't do it.
I did the live event with Jim Cregan from Jimmy's Iced Coffee, and he'd just sold to Britvic back in July after like 12-13 years. And it was, you know, he was just like, you know, I was like, you know, what was the plan? Was it always to sell it, or was it to pass it on to your children? He was like, pass it on to my children. This is the worst business in the world. That's what my children would want to kill me if I handed this down.
Wow.
And he's like, if I knew what I was getting into 12, 13 years ago, I would have never got into this, you know?
Okay.
And it's just those highs and lows that he was saying. I remember going to their Christmas party and, you know, me saying to him, and this is coming out next week, folks. Me coming out saying to him, you know, how's the year been? And he was like, oh, it's brilliant. This week we got into Boots. We're in Sainsbury's now. We're in Morrison's. And then about an hour later, he was like, actually, I told you it's been a really great year. It's actually shit. I've just had a phone call today and Tesco's are going to pull all of our products off the shelves. Man. And I was like, shit, how much are Tesco's important to the business? He was like, 80%. I was like, oh my God, you know, and it's just that the roller coaster gets used all the time, but it is so frigging true.
It's true. I saw a clip from Elon Musk the other day, and he was saying that, in his words, people say that running a business is a lot of fun, and he was going, for some small parts, it is, but a lot of it is awful. It's not that bad, but there are points when it's really tough and it's really hard, and then there are points where it's great fun and you believe in it so much, and it's the overwhelming, for me anyway, it's the overwhelming desire and passion that what we have, that we believe in what we have and what we can do and where we can go, that keeps us going. But there are definitely tough moments in it. I think every founder knows that, right? But I think perhaps only other founders can actually really empathise in the right way. But
probably. And also I think what's interesting, given the space you're in and working with a lot of athletes and sports teams, is that you kind of mirror that with their individual journeys, you know, the highs and the lows of being an athlete, or, you know, getting injured and having to, you know, spend 9 to 12 months on an ACL or something, like coming back from something like that.
I mean, I think sports teaches you a lot of good lessons in life anyway, and I played a lot of sports growing up, not to any particular good level. Again, I was like good at a lot of things but not great at anything. But I like the mindset of anyone who's played sports, either in a team, individual, hopefully both.
Because you
can tell often, like when you hire people, if they play team sports, how they work with everyone, that kind of dynamic you have, resilience that you learn from playing 100%. Sports is so valuable. I've got two young boys at the moment. I want them to play sports growing up because I think it tells you, it teaches you a lot about life.
Yeah,
you know, and also it teaches about that point. You're not going to win every time you play sports. However good you are, you will always lose at some point, and how you come back from that is really important.
Yeah.
So, you know, sports, and I remember at some point they were taking that competitive nature out of school sports. It's like, it doesn't make any sense because it helps you prepare you
it's
for life.
Yeah, exactly. How old are your kids, by the way?
I've got twin boys of 1.5.
Oh, wow, okay. I'm at the other end of the scale. I'm 14 and 16 with two girls. It's interesting seeing.
I can imagine that is tough for all kinds of different reasons.
So last couple of questions. So any advice for those who may be similarly thinking, and there will be people listening right now, that they want to ditch the day job. It's the dawn of a new year. You know, podcast downloads go up, job searches go up, people starting businesses go. I remember at Virgin Startup, biggest month of the year for inquiries for starting a business is like January. Any advice like 4 years in? There was a sigh.
it's a tough one, that one. It's actually, in some ways, it's not... Whatever advice I give would be personal to me in some ways. And actually, you've kind of got to look at why you really want to do it.
Mm.
And actually, do you actually know what you're getting yourself into as well, in some ways? And do you really believe in what it is you're doing? And for me, it was actually, I knew I didn't want to do what I was doing. So I quit and actually didn't have a plan going forward. And I was comfortable with that, right? So again, are you comfortable with that and the unknown? And if you are, great. It's a difficult one, that one.
Did you have a bit of a safety blanket? Because when I did that, yeah. I had the safety blanket, the year's salary that Virgin gave me. So yeah. It was a bit of a...
So I did as well. Because I thought a year in advance I'm going to do this.
Yeah.
So I built it up and actually then it gave me something to add a bit of time. And I think that... It depends when you do it in your life as well. Mm. So I kind of started...
Responsibility-wise.
I made the jump into the startup life before kids in my kind of mid-30s when I had a bit of money and actually not huge responsibilities. That was perfect. Obviously now it's changed a little bit. So you've got to think about that. If you've got family, children, or the rest of it, kind of how does that work?
True.
I don't necessarily think you... I think it depends how much you really want it. I didn't have an idea of what I was going to do and I was comfortable to do it. And I think a lot of people think, you got to have an idea and then you've got to go and
yeah.
You know that. You don't have to. What I found is once I was in the startup world, opportunities started to come and I started to find things. And now I'm pretty sure if I want to do something else, I'm going to find it really quickly.
And it's a lot smaller world than people realize. Yeah. I suddenly realized, especially when I was doing like the live events, you spit the same conversations with the same VCs, the same angel investors, founders, etc. It's interesting.
So maybe the advice on that one actually be get yourself into the startup world. There's so many things that, like boot camps and things you can do to get an idea of actually what you want to do. And I guess the final thing would be, for me, and I found this in the startup journey, is experience is incredibly important. Things you've done before ladders up really well to kind of making the business successful.
Mm-hmm.
So anything that you're doing should hopefully have a purpose to what you're looking to achieve going forward. Now, again, like I run Hytra and I'm 41 now. Now, if I hadn't had that 15 years, 20 years down the city beforehand, I wouldn't be able to run Hytra.
Yeah.
There's a lot about kind of coming out about 21-year-old founder. I know you had Stephen Bartlett on this pod, right?
Yeah.
They are the exception to the rule, right? It's not normal for a 21-year-old to be able to run a really successful startup. They are absolutely exceptional individuals.
Yeah.
Most successful startups are people in the mid-40s. I think there's some Harvard Business Review done data on that.
Mm.
It's because experience counts for a lot. So if you're thinking about making the jump, think about what experience that you've got is then relevant for that jump, and then you can make it successful. And if you don't have that, maybe think about what you need to go and do before you jump and make that jump. It doesn't just happen like that. You know, you have to think about what the skills you need.
I always remember just like listening to, you know, when he took his podcast seriously and went all in on it, and I just remember, you know, listening to Diary of a CEO, and 20-year-olds don't talk like that. Sound so knowledgeable and so assured and confident, and to ask those kind of insightful questions. I'm like, wow, fair play, kudos.
I'm interested. So when you had him on before he was famous, right, really?
Yeah.
I think when he was still at Social Chain, I think.
Yeah, correct.
So did you think this was a trajectory of him when you did the podcast?
It's a good question. I would say... never saw the trajectory that he was going to go on, but definitely him and Dom, his co-founder, who have interviewed as well, who I absolutely got on with like a house on fire, loved Dom. I thought these guys are clearly going places. Okay. They've clearly, you know, they've got vision, they've got the drive, because you can have the vision without the drive and you're not going to get out of bed and actually put the work in. But I never assumed he would. He didn't even have a podcast at that stage.
Yeah.
So to then get the number one podcast in the UK and then Europe, and then he's clearly going for the US.
Yeah.
Very impressive. And hats off to him, to be fair, for doing that. So I think I probably know the answer to this question, but are you where you want to be?
So what's my answer going to be then?
I think going on the answers that you've given, that when you've set a goal, you're then ready for the next goal. Yeah. I was going to say, no, you kind of feel like you've just taken off, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's a few different ways I could answer. I mean, firstly, we're still an early stage company, right? So there's plenty more to do on Hydro. Mm. And, you know, I can't wait for it to, you know, be a much bigger company with a much bigger team where we can really kind of, you know, make that impact that we want to, particularly in the medical kind of space, because we can really improve the lives of millions of people with our product. And I'm really looking forward to seeing that. But yeah, in terms of where it ends up being, where we want to get to, I think it's the journey. We're just going to carry on this because it can do so many things. You know, when we're, for example, like a non-negotiable in pro sports, like we get to that point where every team will have Hydro because it makes sense. Yeah. That'll be a great moment for us. There's so many things that happened so far. Like in the World Cup, there's a video that the Belgium national football team put out of all the entire squad wearing Hydro recovering in a swimming pool. Like you had Kevin De Bruyne.
Gold,
you know,
dust.
Yeah, it's amazing. We didn't put that. They put it out. It's a really proud moment for us. Mm. I want to see more of that. More of that. More teams using Hydro. More players using Hydro, and then more individuals using Hydro for different reasons. Mm. I think I've got this in the back of my mind that one day I'll be, you know, stood in a queue for a coffee shop and you have maybe kind of like an old man in front of you saying, oh, I've been using Hydro to help me with my kind of knee replacement surgery. And behind you, you've got maybe a young female athlete who's going, I'm using it for hypertrophy or something. And then there's another guy over there using it for something else. And everybody's using Hydro in different ways. And we've got a product that is kind of seamlessly integrated into everyday use. And it's like, that would be the end goal.
Got it.
So seamlessly integrate BFR into everyday use. And that's the end point for us.
Big goal, but I love it. Yeah, big thinking. Last question. What do you think was the one thing that you personally needed to be able to screw it, just do it and get to where you want to be?
I kind of think for me, though, it's not really one thing. But again, the screw it, just do it moment for Hydro really was when Warren said to me, can you take a look at this document that I have? And he sent across this document, which I started reading through, which is all about, obviously, the genesis of Hydro. And I popped it across to our co-founder, Paul Harter. And I said to him, there's something in here. There's something in this. We should have a look at it. And then we started looking into it. And then the scale of the opportunity became clear. And at that point, we had another business. And it was actually the realization that this is a better business than the business we had or could be, right? Mm. It's a huge, the opportunity, when you start looking at it and analyzing what Hydro could be, and obviously it wasn't called Hydro, that was just an idea about BFR and how you make it wearable.
Yeah.
You start to go, this could impact everything. Everybody could use this for so many different things. The use cases are phenomenal. And so we had to go as the business owner. So Paul and I owned a different business and we were running that and it was doing okay at the time. We had to go, actually, we've got to put that aside, we've got to actually forget about it, and we've got to do Hydro because this is the way forward. And so that was the screw it, just doing it for that. Yeah. And
that's then, massive.
So in some ways, all Warren's fault that really ruined that other business. So yeah.
And what was that other business?
It was a health, fitness, nutrition coaching business. So it's kind of a high-end PT business. Warren Paul and I were kind of founders of that. Paul founded it, I was the CEO of that. And then we hired Warren to help us with our clients. And then after a few months of getting to know us, he said, I've got this idea. He'd already spent all his money on a patent because he just believed it. He had no idea how to take it to market. He just so believed in what it was. He'd spent the money on a patent.
Oh, really?
And he met Paul and I. He's like, you know, Paul's an ex, really senior lawyer. He used to be a high-flying M&A lawyer. I've obviously worked in the kind of business, and so we had a skill set that he didn't have. Mm. He said, could you look at this? And I was like, yeah, sure. I didn't know what to expect. And then I was like, what is this?
The opportunity is huge. Yeah. No, I'm excited for you. You know, I genuinely am. Mm. It's the more I've heard about it from yourself, having, you know, read about it and listened to podcasts, et cetera, about your story and the Hydro, it's just like, wow. I just keep, you know, as I've articulated you, and I keep thinking of other opportunities that no doubt you've kicked around a million times. So
we'll get you some shorts as well, so then you can become a believer in the product as well. So,
I love that. Yeah. Brilliant. Yeah, amazing. Okay, well, look, Raj, much appreciated. Thank you for coming on the show.
No, thank you very much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for watching this episode of Screw It, Just Do It. Let me know what you thought of it in the comments below this video. Has this episode helped move you closer to where you want to be? All that I ask is that if you enjoyed this episode and that it's moved you closer to getting to where you want to be, that you share this episode so that it helps one other person do just the same. Just ask yourself what small action will move you forward to get you from where you are, and screw it and just do it. Until next time.